I visited St. Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin recently. If you're not religious and live very close to it, as in my case, it's easy to keep passing it by, ignoring the way it encapsulates the history and spirit of our capital city. But even the occasional visit reminds you of what it means to be a Dubliner. Sometimes it's thronged with visitors, drawn by its central location in the inner city tourist trail. But at other times, the only sound can be your own footsteps, those and the whisperings of the ghosts. Do I believe in ghosts? No, of course I don't. But somehow, there are places in this ancient city of ours where you doubt your rational senses. St. Patrick's is one of them, in part because the most dominant ghost of all is the great, angry 18th century Dean, Jonathan Swift, whom we point to with pride. We like to forget that he railed against his posting to Dublin, a precipitate descent from the court of Queen Anne, where he had hoped for great preferment. But the Dean haunts another building even more closely, or so they say. That's the Deanery, the gracious Queen Anne house that is still home to the Deans of St. Patrick's. Situated behind a high wall on Kevin Street, alongside the old Kevin Street Garda station, the Deanery has survived the Philistinism of Dublin city authorities through the ages, and, it has to be said, the Church of Ireland authorities as well. It houses a portrait of the Dean. He stands against the dining room window with the cathedral in the background, but there's no spire. It was painted before the spire was built. And sitting in that dining room today, facing the actual window shown in the portrait, but with the spire soaring outside, raises the hair on the back of your neck. And it's easy to understand why so many people familiar with the old house are willing to swear that the great Dean sometimes crosses the lofty hall in the quiet of the evening. I believe those who swear by it and who say that the shadowy presence is a warm and comforting one. We might have lost this beautiful house with its rich history were it not for another very great Dean, Victor Griffin, and his wife Daphne. When Victor Griffin was appointed Dean of St. Patrick's in 1968, his and Daphne's twin sons were small boys, and the authorities, presumably with the best will in the world, suggested that they might not want to rear their boys in the inner city. The deanery could be sold for redevelopment, it was suggested, and a nice new deanery could be built in the suburbs, maybe somewhere like Fox Rock. Dean Griffin told me years later that he didn't have to call on Christian charity in his refusal. Daphne exploded. And the preservation of the lovely and historic old house is not all Dublin has to thank Victor Griffin for. A farmer's son from County Wicklow and a graduate of TCD, his early ministry was in Northern Ireland, where he met and married Daphne. But in 1968, on being appointed Dean, he adopted Dublin with open arms and was made one of the Irish People of the Year in 1979, with good reason. He was one of the leaders of the campaign to preserve the Woodkey Viking remains from the depredations of the City Council, along with Mary Robinson and Reverend F.X. Martin of UCD. And though they failed, less than a decade later, he was the founder, with journalist Frank MacDonald, of the Dublin Crisis Conference, when he saw our capital city's heritage being further threatened with devastation. Not just that, St. Patrick's, our greatest and most beautiful church, which had survived everything from plague to war and famine since the year 1190, and where Cromwell had contemptuously stabled his horses, was under threat. Sitting in St. Patrick's last week and with the traffic pounding past along Clanbrassil Street, I thought about it all. In 1986, the City Council of the time had cast its eyes on Clanbrassil Street to make access to the city easier. The plan was for a six-lane highway, less than 50 yards from the cathedral walls. Any fool would have known that the foundations of the cathedral would be undermined, but not apparently the city fathers or the national government. But they reckoned without Victor Griffin, classical scholar, theologian, and street fighter. There's no six-lane highway running past St. Patrick's today. We could do with that fighting spirit nowadays, when many of us think the ancient heart of our capital city is being ruthlessly destroyed in the name of progress. Daphne Griffin contracted multiple sclerosis early in their marriage, and I asked him once in an interview how it was possible not to lose faith in a merciful God after such a cruel blow. "I won't say I didn't get very angry with God," he told me. Human to his valiant core. And thinking about him last week as I sat in St. Patrick's, thanking his shade for his fierce spirit that was such a gift to his country in times of crisis, I knew that if Swift haunts his deanery, Victor Griffin has joined hands with him to watch over the jewel that is their cathedral. St. Patrick's is about to undergo renovation. The two great deans can be depended upon to watch over it, and let the city fathers put that in their pipes and smoke it.
Soyez sauvage. A photograph, black and white, two old women dancing in a kitchen, their backs straight, their white hair shining. You can almost see the turn of the tune. You can almost feel the tenderness of their touch. The floor alive beneath their feet. Such sure-footedness. The world alive outside the window, a white thorn in blossom. The image is perfect. A still life in motion, a landscape in stillness. You can almost touch the music. The dancers are sisters, Bridie and Kathleen. Both reared families, both loved music. The moment the dance is lensed and set by their nephew, who had played his concertina earlier, watched them dancing, then chose cassette music, irresistible, to lift them up again, so he can lift his camera and click. Two sisters, old and light, dancing forever. Click again. The Dordogne, Périgueux, 1941. Bridie is a postulant in the Order of St. Martha. She works in the garden, her brown skin browner from the sun, her black hair shining, her curls wild and free, her strong hands marked from earth and rose. A German regiment occupies the convent. The commandant questions Mère Marie, "Who is hiding here?" Takes Bridie to be a young Jewish woman, will not believe her strong French is that of an Irish Catholic. Plans to transport her to a holding camp, and then, who knows? Something, papers, patience, mother's art of persuasion saves her. She sails for Ireland weeks later, settles back in Clare, rarely speaks of France or history. But to her nephew, she murmurs occasional words of a language she loved, tells him the story of the convent and Mère Marie. "Soyez sauvage," she urges him. "Stay wild, untamed." Years on. "I do my best," he says. "Concertina and camera are my wings. It's what you witness can be the burden."
Qualifying matches for the European Championships played in June, such as Ireland's games over this weekend, always bring to mind the famous victory over England in Euro 88. Our first ever defeat of the old enemy in a competitive soccer match lifted the heart of the nation, to the extent that it's even been credited with having kick-started the Celtic Tiger. But its effect was felt far beyond these shores, as I would soon find out. The week after that match, I set off for Vietnam, where I was a regular visitor as I worked for Trocra at that time. The country was then a hardline communist state supported by the Soviet Union. The capital, Hanoi, retained something of its colonial elegance, but it was mostly a down-at-heel city, devoid of colourful advertising, interesting shops, or anything approaching bright lights. The airport was similarly lacking in charm. The only intercontinental flight was the weekly Aeroflot arrival from Moscow. I would arrive on a Vietnam Airlines flight from Bangkok. At immigration, I would present my Irish passport. Firstly, I would be looked up and down by a stern, unsmiling officer. He would examine the passport quizzically, frown, lean back and knock on a nearby office door, which would open slightly, allowing him to pass it to someone inside. I would be waved aside to let other passengers through. Eventually, the door would open, the passport would reappear, and a sharp voice would issue an instruction. I'd be summoned back to the passport desk, where the stern official would look me up and down all over again, then hand me my stamped passport without a word being spoken. It wasn't just at the airport I experienced this unfamiliarity with our fair isle. Whenever I phoned home from Vietnam, after requesting to be put through to Ireland by the operator, I would invariably be greeted by, "Hello, this is Reykjavik." For some reason, everyone has heard of Iceland. So on my arrival into Hanoi some days after the historic victory, I prepared for the usual routine. I handed in the passport. It was checked out with the usual curiosity. Then, to my surprise, the officer looked at me with a growing smile on his face. "Anilan," he asked. "Anilan, very good football." He stamped my passport with gusto and handed it back to me with a beaming smile. Recognition at last. I later discovered that Soviet television was broadcasting the Euros into Vietnam. The Soviet Union were also competing and would qualify for the final against the Netherlands, to be played the day before I would leave for home. I was staying in the rundown, rat-infested Hotel Thong Nhat, which translates to English as Great Victory. How apt, I thought, given our recent result. Rickshaw drivers would always gather outside the hotel in the hopes of getting a well-paid fare from a foreigner. The night of the final, I told one of them I'd like to watch the match, and did he know anywhere I could see it? He assured me he did. "How much?" I asked him. $5, he replied, chancing his arm. This would be a small fortune to him. "Done," I said, to his amazement. I was just so delighted that I'd get to see the match. I felt it was great value. We set off into the dark Hanoi streets. After a couple of minutes, we turned left, then shortly left again. 100 metres on, he pulled up outside a simple restaurant where a crowd was gathering. We were in the street right behind my hotel. He was grinning ear to ear as I handed over the $5. Well, I thought, I wouldn't have found this on my own, so everyone's a winner. At two tables at the front of the restaurant beside the TV, a large group of Soviets were drinking Russian champagne, getting their celebrations in early. There were other foreigners seated at the few other tables, whom I joined. Gathered around the open door was a large group of young locals. The game kicked off. The champagne-fueled Soviets were in great form, getting noisier as the match progressed. We foreigners were enjoying the game despite the over-exuberance of our red friends. Outside, the locals watched, exchanging murmured comments. 35 minutes in, the Netherlands scored. Disgust at the top tables, smiles in the middle, unreadable expressions outside. Early in the second half, the Soviets got a penalty. The top tables grew tense. The kicker missed, and amidst a barrage of blue language, the entire Soviet group got up and left. At which point, the locals dashed in and commandeered the top tables, from where they cheered on the Netherlands lustily. And when the Dutch added the second goal, the place went wild. It was hard to credit that this was happening in a city that had known only hardline communist rule for more than 30 years. Longer, I thought, than most of those cheering young Vietnamese men had been alive. They say that sport shouldn't be mixed with politics, but it can offer interesting insights. I'd seen how, for the Vietnamese, the Soviet Union was a brooding, heavy-handed presence. They would refer to the Soviets as the Yanks with no dollars, and who, for all their socialist solidarity, showed little respect for the Vietnamese people. As for Ireland's newfound recognition in the country, did not require a military alliance to achieve it, but it took an army nonetheless, Jackie's army, to deliver it.
Blue as the sea off Aran Moor. Colour tones surround these islands. Blue-green of glass bottles, aqua of innocence, silver-blue of the herring, once abundant in these waters, bluish-grey of a leaping dolphin, sapphire-blue of clear memories, the low-tide teal of loss, brown-blue of churned sand, churned secrets, midnight-blue of shackled souls. The sea holds the antique blue of history, blue of tears, emigrant tears, navy as ink, on letters sent and letters received. The ultramarine of community, high tides bluing as depths gather, dark as a storm, then lighting to reflect a summer sky. The diamond blue shimmer on the waves and their crystal clear wash to the shore. Ripples roll in turquoise tones of youth, pure as hope, cresting to the blue of a cormorant's feathers as it takes flight, while the island's young now take flight, and the tide turns again to the colour of tears, emigrants' tears.
It was a busy record shop with music blaring and an unrelated film playing on a large screen. There were staff members stocking shelves and customers coming and going, making the occasional inquiry about one artist or another. I was wandering pretty aimlessly, checking out the folk section before moving on to the other end of the shop and the stacks of vinyl that are, again, part and parcel of the music business. I leafed through the reissues of albums I'd bought in my teens and twenties. And then, without warning, a sudden wave of sadness broke over me. And just as suddenly, the shop seemed filled with the shadowy figures of young men and women I had known growing up, and their younger brothers and sisters whom I had taught. There were the shadows of students who had danced on Saturday nights, boys and girls who had jived and swayed in the almost derelict youth club in Castledermot in the early 70s. Teenagers who had danced in the same decrepit building 10 years later when I worked in the village as a teacher. There was the smiling girl who was waked in her wedding dress a week before what should have been her wedding day. The young man whose life came to a sudden and untimely close on a moonlit road, the engine of his motorbike still roaring long after the life had gone from his broken body. The beautiful, laughing young woman whose life ended in childbirth. They and a dozen others jostled gently around me, looking over my shoulders, searching for a favourite album or song among the stacked racks of vinyl. I listened carefully to their laughter and wordless chatter as they argued about the merits or otherwise of this band or that. I saw them frown over the names of singers who had surfaced long after they had gone, the frustration of unheard music and unlearned words furrowing their brows. What had they missed in leaving early? What tunes might they have whistled or sung had they lived longer? And suddenly, on that cold, bright morning, a night fell. But what night? Any one of 100 when the music played from the twin decks in the corner of that sad old building that was, for those 3 or 4 hours, transformed by coloured bulbs and the smell of weak coffee and the laughter of teenagers into everything that life had to offer. Concern, nervousness, hope, love, a kiss, a word, a promise, an arrangement, the thought of a long starlit walk home. And all the time the music played and the body swayed, slow or fast, and everything was possible. My eyes fell on a couple dancing slowly, his arms wrapped protectively around her, her head on his shoulder. And they were lost in the shared dream of a life that lay ahead. And part of me wanted to tap them on the shoulders and tell them the truth that I knew about their lives. But I didn't. Couldn't. Instead, I let them dance away, enfolded by the music and the possibility of the moment. Grief and loss would come in their own bad time. For now, I left them with their love and hope and wrestled with my own sadness, that emotion that comes trailing memory and the knowledge of what might have been. I couldn't help but think of the lives that young couple had hoped for and aspired to. But for then, for that time between remembering and stepping back into the real world beyond the swinging doors of the record shop, I stood and watched them dance and listened to the Poppy family singing "Which Way You Going, Billy?" and wished I could have warned them of the traps and snares that lay ahead. But we live in the now, and perhaps that is one of the saving graces of this life.
At the time of my leaving cert, things were fraught at home. I had no interest whatsoever in studying. I was counting the days until the outdoor swimming season began. Add to that, I was and still am a voracious reader, and back then Hemingway was my main man. I had a dream. I wanted to be an Olympic swimmer and a writer. My mother had a dream. She wanted me to be a teacher or a nurse. Barrington's Hospital was just around the corner from our house, and Mam was well in with the matron. And with that in mind, she brought me there to have a chat with her. Yes, indeed, there would be a place for me as a probationer, provided I passed my leaving cert. I wouldn't mind being a nurse. However, there was one minor hiccup. I was barely 17 years old and would have to wait until I was 18 to be accepted for training. A full year of waiting, if I passed my leaving cert. Matron suggested that in the interim, I should do a secretarial course for, as she put it, something to fall back on. And I should join the Red Cross, which would ease me nicely into my nursing career. Grand. I took out yet another Hemingway from the library and read it under the pretext of studying. The nun at school had a dream for all 15 of us in the class. She wanted us to achieve high honours, to go out into the world and make our mark. There was a group of girls that she nodded at knowingly. The four or five who opted for a religious life and would be convent bound immediately after the exam. All through the month of May, we were offered extra study time. We were sent home when regular school hours finished at 4 o'clock so that we could have a bite to eat and return refreshed by 4:30. I loved that little break. I had our house all to myself as Mum went to help Grandmother in her shop. Once home, I turned on our new Pi radio and tuned into the BBC Light programme from Mrs. Dale's diary. I scrambled 2 eggs, made toast, and sat on the big armchair by the window. I listened to Mrs. Dale telling the world and its mother for the umpteenth time, "I'm rather worried about Jim." She sounded so very respectable and comfortable. Well, she would be. She was a doctor's wife living in Virginia Lodge, Parkwood Hill, wherever that was. Yes, it was scrambled eggs every day, and I left the pot soaking in the sink for Mum to clean. Then I dashed down the sandmall to sit in the sunshine on the wall of Annie Clancy's garden to read and maybe meet the boys from the CBS on their way home. Annie had a tiny garden where a sort of fern grew up through the black earth like asparagus spears. It had
greyish leaves that were wrapped around long green stems. Eventually those leaves unfurled and their weight made the stems bend over into an elegant arc. All along the spine of each stem there were little white flowers, just like a necklace of pearls. Annie called the plant the Bells of St. Mary's. Well, we did live in St. Mary's Parish, after all, and the nuns had given her a cutting from their one so that she could grow it. Annie and I chatted about flowers, the scented roses growing next door, the lily of the valley creeping along the inside wall, and the mock orange blossom that had a perfume so sweet it would almost knock you out. "Perhaps you should study horticulture," she said. I sighed. Everyone had some idea of what I should be. But what could I be? A writer? An Olympic swimmer? I did the secretarial course, where I trained in the skill of touch typing, and nursing was sidelined when I got myself a permanent pensionable position in local government. I joined the Red Cross, and my team won the President's Trophy, the All-Ireland First Aid Championship. And I met President and Band De Valera at Ars an Uachtaráin for the presentation of our award. I didn't make it as an Olympic swimmer, but I became a swimming teacher and retired recently after 35 of the best years of my life. And as for horticulture, if you come into my garden sometime, I'll show you my special plant that originally came from Annie Clancy's garden. It's not, as she told me, the Bells of St. Mary's. It's called Solomon's Seal, a beautiful reminder of my Leaving Cert days.